Gamenidzirib. Welcome to the Tommy Tiernan Show, a chat show where we don't know who the guest is until they walk out. And sometimes we don't even know who they are after they've walked out. So we're coming live today from the Ivy Gardens, which is a beautiful little park in the middle of Dublin. I remember one of the gamekeepers telling me a story about this one time. He found this poor unfortunate man who had taken a lot of heroin in one of the bushes. And he was gone blue, like he was on the verge of passing on to his next incarnation. God bless him, God be good to him. But the gardener fella says, well, I've got to do something to help him. So he called an ambulance and the people arrived and they jumped out and they started trying to resuscitate him and stuff like that, and wasn't happening. Then they did the electric shocks on his chest and they saved his life. Not as far as he was concerned. As far as he was concerned, they were after wrecking his boats. I swear to God, the gardener said the first words he said after being brought back to life were, "Oh, what you do that for? That cost me 20 quid." So my beautiful companion here, Fred Cook, beside me. How are you, Fred?
So, I'm fantastic, Tommy. Thank you. Cheers. I'm at the moment, I can't drive, so I'm learning how to drive. I applied for the theory test, and I even got the book there last week. I got a free CD with it. I'm delighted. Haven't listened to any of the songs yet, but I'm sure they're good. But it's so annoying now because my father even left me to this show this morning from Kells with the Ed Sheeran traffic and everything. I was 2 hours in the car with my dad, just the two of us, and then halfway through the car journey, he decided to say something, right? And he turned around to me and he goes, "Fred, why don't you sit up the front beside me?" And I replied, "Oh, sorry, Dad, I'm in showbiz now. Things have changed."
You better be careful. Driving in Ireland can be awful boring. You know, I live in Galway, you know, and that motorway, honest to God, my favourite part of the motorway is the bit after the toll booth, you know, where there's no road markings. Tell you, if a man wanted to learn how to do donuts, that'd be the place to do it. Spinning round and round. So I was been up here. Of course, it's a very social event, you know, and going out drinking. It's hard, isn't it, Fred? It's hard to.
I've been drinking for 4 years. Wow. And,
I'm one of the only people. I was off drink for a long time. I was off drink for 8 years, and I must be one of the only people in the world, I would imagine. My wife asked me to start again. We were on holidays down in Cork, and she said, "You are no crack." And she got me up against a wall and said, "There's a bottle of wine in the fridge, drink it." And then the kids came out and said, "Daddy, please don't be sober again this Christmas." So I come from a long line now of good drinkers. Like, the Tiernans is good drinkers. Like no alcoholics, but good, great men for porter. And I got a phone call from one of my relations recently, a fine man for drink. And they said, "Bad news, Tom, bad news. That went to the hospital there during the week." He's getting old. He's been in his 70s, you know. "So in the hospital there, Tom, the doctor said, I can't drink anymore. Just the same amount."
Does the carnage have a lock-in as well? Like, there's many fine Dublin pubs that have a lock-in, and I know, like, some Americans here. I got an Irish guy to come up on stage once to explain to American people what a lock-in was, and he came up on stage and he looked at all the American people and he went, "A lock-in is when you drink till you die." And all the Americans were quite scared, right? But all the Irish were like, "Fair play to you, Seamus. I couldn't have said it better myself. Seamus Heaney is alive and well."
If the Irish were doing a version of Guantanamo, they'd be taking terrorist suspects and leaving them on Loch Derg and filling them full of porter till they died. "Give that man more pints, he'll talk after that." Porter boarding. We live in a beautiful world, don't we? Gorge Ed Sheeran playing in Croke Park last night, you know, fantastic. He's playing again tonight and he's playing for Galway on Sunday against Cork. So that's the triple header. Lovely little man is Ed. Gorgeous. I'll be loving you till you're 70. And after that, you're on your own. I ain't hanging around with no wild one. You may go the dote on your bike after that, missus. No, it's a gorgeous world, and it's a world full of surprises and miracles. Like, people forget, we live in a world, like, newspapers and television, they all try and reduce the size of your head. You know, I feel, there's no point in me thinking about stuff that other people is thinking about. So if other people is thinking about stuff, sure, there's no need for me to get involved at all. I can just drift off and do my own thinking. And I was philosophizing recently about how gorgeous this planet is, like. They're after finding a new Earth, aren't they?
Mm.
Out in space, like.
Carlo.
Carlo's twinned with their Bermuda Triangle. But the world we have here, like, is beautiful enough. We live in a world, lads, where a caterpillar climbs into a sleeping bag and a butterfly walks out. Isn't that amazing? That's the world we live in. That's like a donkey getting into a Nissan Micra and an ostrich walking out. That's the world we live in. I feel I'm up for adventure, you know, and I was thinking about Columbus, you know, Christopher Columbus, and when he left Galway.
He got a degree in marine biology from GMIT. And
when he left Galway, he didn't know where America was. He didn't even know it was called America. He just knew that he wanted to go that way. And that's just a fantastic way of living, like, you know, that you don't need to know where you're going. You don't, if you know exactly where you're going, then it's not an adventure, is it? You know, we'll just go that way. So I'm the kids are all very worried now because I've told them for summer holidays. I haven't booked anything. We're just going that way. Fingers crossed. So anyway, so let the adventure continue. So Fred, who do we have on the show first?
Tommy Tiernan, our first guest, is the wonderful Panty!
Now. How are you, Panty? Cheers, Ed. Visions of Julie Goodyear in Coronation Street behind the bar.
I'll take that.
Wow. You're a fine-looking human.
I could say the same about yourself.
How are you after all? Is all them shenanigans over?
They're all long over.
And did you feel when it was happening, like, it was Madonna was talking about you, and I know another Madonna as well, by the way. There's an ostrich in Loud called Madonna. And I asked the farmer, why did you call her Madonna? And he said, because she's got some neck.
I met Madonna at a funeral once, and we ended up sitting at this table having, like, the lunch thing all together. And, of course, I'm a big gay. I grew up with Madonna, so I'm a bit like, oh, my God, it's fucking Madonna. Anyway, she was all easy and good. But at the end, and I had this Italian friend with me, and it was the funeral was here out in Paris Court, and he wanted to stay for the rest of the party, but I had to go back. I had things to be doing in town, so I was leaving. And he was like, "Oh, but you know, he'd come from Rome to go to this funeral." And
was it the Pope?
No, it wasn't. And I was like, "Oh, you stay because you know somebody will just give you a lift back into town. It'll be grand." Yeah. But he was, you know, he wasn't comfortable with that. I don't know, maybe Italians are just a little whatever. So I was like, "It'll be fine. Everyone's going back in town." And he's just like, "Oh, he wanted to stay, but he didn't want to do that." And so then I could sort of hear myself turning into my Mayo mother, going, "Madonna, Madonna, you came in a big car, didn't you? You'll take Sergio back into town, which you won't you when you're going back." You had to be car. I saw that. Sure, you can say that. You'll take surgery. And in fairness to Madonna, she did. Wow.
She sounds like that. She is so. would you have an interest now in the operations and all that? Would that suit you?
What gender reassignment?
Yeah, like, because I wouldn't know much about what you're at like. like, what point are you trying to make exactly?
God, no. I'm totally happy in myself.
All right, okay.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I sometimes think, you know, I'm lucky. I get to do both.
You're happy and scary.
Am I scary?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. There's a touch of... Now, I don't mean to... Like, do you remember the fella who was making the dress out of the fat girls back in The Science of the Lambs?
Oh, right.
And she was down in the well, and he was down, "Throw me the dog! Throw me the dog!"
What? There's a big difference between, a fat girl's back and, you know, a bit of polyester, you know.
So I would just be curious as to, like, so it's not like, Eddie Izzard, who is a great comic and a fine human being, he'd be a transvestite as well.
Yeah.
And his thing was always that it's just, it's nothing to do with gender, almost. That it was to do with... I don't know what it was to do with. But
I tell you, that people get confused by all that, by like, what's a transvestite, what's a drag queen, you know, what's a transgender person. You know, they get them all confused because sort of visually they kind of look at them and they, you know, whatever. And there are these labels, so like Eddie Izzard would be a transvestite, somebody who's, you know, a heterosexual, fully male person who is, you know, find some sort of comfort or something, you know, in feminine stuff or whatever. Yeah. And then there are transgender people who feel they're sort of, you know, the gender they were born with does not match the body that they have.
Yeah.
And then traditionally a drag queen is somebody who's doing it sort of for entertainment purposes, playing with the ideas of gender. But it's just not that simple because, you know, you'll find drag queens
Jesus,
who are
that
transgender.
Didn't sound simple now.
Well, you know, people like to put them into these three separate categories, but there's a very much a blurring of the lines between those categories depending on the individual. So you can talk about those things in broad strokes for a sort of an academic discussion, but when it comes right down to it and you walk up to, you know, some drag queen somewhere, you know, their story might be different.
Yeah.
So it doesn't get easier, it gets more complicated.
Is it something you do for a living?
In my case, yeah. But I sometimes wonder to myself, you know, so I have this sort of outlet where I can express, you know, a feminine side of myself and a masculine side of myself, you know, and can do both and, you know, sort of slip between them. And I sometimes wonder if I didn't have that outlet, well, maybe I wouldn't be, you know, so comfortable in
who I am. So theoretically, like, you could marry yourself.
I could. I don't know if I could put up with myself. You know, the rows would be massive.
You could have male Rory and Lady Panty. And
you could.
They could be some kind of a digital... one half you get married one day and the other half get married the other day and you get some editors to put it together and you're both married on the same day.
Yeah. Well, if you listen to some people, now that we have gay marriage, sure, you can, you know, it's a slippery slope and you'll be marrying animals next. So, you know, why not marry myself?
Yeah. so you work...
Yeah,
I'm curious as well as when it comes to when men dress up as women, who they want to dress up like. So it's like for a lot of men my age, they're dressed up like women in outfits that would have looked glamorous in the 70s,
yes,
or the 80s. Like you've a big Julie Goodyear Rover's Return vibe and you're there now. And
I was thinking more Farrah Fawcett.
Yeah, after a few drinks maybe, yeah. Cheers. Farrah's been lashing into the harp again. So is it's not so it's not contemporary. You're not trying to look like, I don't know, Nicki Minaj, whatever the hell she looks like, or, you know...
Well, I mean, that's all personal. So I would know drag queens who are, have a totally contemporary look or whatever.
Okay.
But like most people, I, you know, I sort of like the things that I've always liked. And so I have always visually been, in, you know, influenced by, you know, the kind of things that I grew up with, like Charlie's Angels, for example. My biggest influence is a movie called The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. 1968 movie, you should all watch it. Maggie Smith won the Oscar for it. It's an incredible movie, and visually, Maggie Smith in that movie is one of my biggest sort of references. But of course, like any girl, you know, you're dressing up and all the time, you know, because that's what girls do. They dress up. They have to do this every day. And you sometimes get bored with, you know, the things you always do. And so sometimes you like to, you know, oh, today I'll try and look like Pamela Anderson, and tomorrow I'll try and look like, you know, Julie Goodyear. I mean, you know, so I mean, that's the fun part of it, because guys, in a way, you know, your average bloke doesn't really have that outlet for creativity and stuff. That's the part that I like, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I like the, like, it takes me 2 hours to get ready, and I spent 2 hours this morning getting ready for you, and I was out late last night, and I could have just, like everybody else, said, oh, fuck it, I'll get up at 10. Oh, can I say that? I don't know. Sorry, I take that back, censor. I forgot. You know, feck it, I'll get up at 10, you know, and just wander in here in a t-shirt, but I can't do that. Yeah, but I can't do that. I have to spend 2 bloody hours in front of the mirror. And sometimes when I sit down to do that, and it's 2 intense hours, this is a special effects makeup job. I'm not really this beautiful. You know, it's kind of intense time on your own. And sometimes when I sit down at the beginning of that 2 hours, I'm like, oh, God. But once you get into it, it's sort of a creative process. And, you know, it's like writing or something. Once you sort of get into it. And there's a kind of a zen quality about it. You know, you've done this so many times, you're half on autopilot. And so I enjoy that part of it.
Was it born out of pain? Like, was there a, when you were like a teenager, was there a thing of, I want to what? Oh, no. Ah. Why can't I just want to play for Liverpool or something?
God, no. It's never been anything but super fun for me, and that's why
I got as a teenager when you first wanted to give it
a
lash?
Well, I wasn't sitting it as a teenager, you know, under my Michael Jackson posters, desperately wanting to dress up, as, you know, in women's clothing. It wasn't that. I was attracted to it as I was, you know, getting into the time when you're going to clubs and nightclubs and all that. And I was interested in sort of the whole sort of transformation, sort of. And you'd see these crazy club kids. A guy called Lee Bowery, I don't know if you've
heard of him. Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he was a huge influence on me. And he didn't dress up in traditional drag. He didn't look like this. He just looked like an alien of some kind.
A big fat man, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Bald and, yeah.
And so that's what got me interested in it. I was enjoying nightclubbing and going out and sticking things to myself and looking weird. And, you know, it was all of that. And it was sort of over time that sort of became more traditionally drag. But so I was never, you know, sitting at home desperately wanting to dress up in women's clothes. That wasn't how it came about for me. But I did always just, you know, think all these rules around things is just bullshit. I've never been good at rules and regulations. And so I always think, well, why the hell can't, you know, a guy, you know, wear a stupid polyester print? You know, why is that so weird? You know, it's totally arbitrary that our culture decided that women should be the peacocks and men should be gray and dull and expressionless. That's utterly arbitrary. And there are other cultures where it's the other way around.
Yeah.
And I just kind of, you know, while all this stuff can be a pain in the ass the girls, it's uncomfortable. Sometimes it's painful, you know, the shoes and all of that stuff. But it's also really fun sometimes to do it. And so I just think people should wear what they want, you know, and who cares?
Do you think that, say, if there's an Islamic man who wanted to dress up like a woman, it'd be awful easier for him, just throw the veil over his face?
Well, you know, just a little eyeliner and you're done, you know? Sometimes.
But Muhammad has it much easier than I do.
Well, that's the other thing, though, is that drag exists all around the world in every culture. Like, it is something, it's deep in there. It's not, you know, just something that we, you know, we play about with. You can go to any country in the world, in any culture, and you'll find, you know, some
North
variations.
Korea.
Yeah, I bet. I'll find you a North Korean drag. Bet you she'll be a scream.
Is it so it's just for fun then? Has it anything to do with inclination in terms of...
Well, everybody's different, like I was trying to say, that, you know, I can't speak for all people sure. who do drag because yeah. they all have their own motivations. So from my point of view, it started out as just this fun, nutty thing. Like when you're 22 and your job is to be paid to go to nightclubs, dress up like, you know, a big, you know, cartoon and be you know, have drinks thrown into you and be paid just to be the life and soul of the party.
Yeah.
I mean, what 22-year-old doesn't want that sure. job? Like, it is the greatest job in the world. So I got into it, you know, from all of that. But for me personally, part of it, is, of course, is it's work and it's a performance, and I'm sort of using these elements of femininity, you know, to enhance the performance yeah. or to say things about gender or, you know, how we're expected to perform gender and on sexuality and all of those things. But for me personally, that's the sort of largest driving force. But I do also enjoy the freedom of it and not caring anymore.
But that's brave, though. That takes bravery to do that.
Well, when I was 25 and I would have had to run through town to go from one gig to another or get a cab, I would have been more nervous about it, and I'd be like, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And I'd be sort of trying to explain to people, you know, I'm just doing this for a job. But as I get older, I think, oh, feck it, you know. And so now I don't care. And as long as I feel physically safe, and, in, you know, 99% of the time I do, I don't care.
What are... So you say it's an adventure and you're starting off and you're kind of doing all this stuff and it's kind of you're playing and you're dressing up and you're... it's an artistic thing.
Yeah.
So as you're getting older and you're doing it for longer and you've got to keep your imagination excited and... keep that adventure going in your head. What risks can you take with drag? Like where does so the achievement has been made of dressing up like a woman
yeah.
and talking like a man.
But see, I would say that I don't dress up like a woman. I just use the sort of tools of femininity. And what I'm presenting here, for me, I'm not trying to persuade anybody that I'm a woman. I'm presenting to you something that is somewhere in between, you know, because nobody here is looking at me thinking, oh, that's a woman. You know, they're thinking...
There's a few fellas down the back.
So I'm just trying to present something that's sort of, in a way, neither male nor female.
Yeah.
And... you know, something that's, well, in a sense, out of the ordinary in some ways, you know, something other or different. And sometimes I think there can be a lot of power in being other or different. I think, you know, in difference, there's power sometimes. God, I'm getting a bit heavy on you here, but you know.
I can take the weight, it's okay.
So for me, like, I get what you're saying. Like, if you had asked me when I was 25 or even 30 or something, you know, do you think you'll still be, you know, wearing these clothes and makeup, you know, in 10 or 15 years' time, I always would have said, oh, God, probably no. Because I never saw it as a career. Like, when I was, you know, 20 or whatever, the only drag queen I had ever even heard of was Mr. Pussy. You know, it's all before the internet and all of that. Nowadays, yeah. You know, everybody sees everything. So the idea that somebody could have made a career out of it never crossed my mind. I thought I was just making a few quid this weekend to pay the rent or whatever and having a great fun time doing it. That's what I thought. I never thought past the next gig or whatever. And I always thought, I guess like all performers do, that the next gig wasn't going to come.
Yeah.
So I was just doing it. And then, you know, it wasn't until I reached 40 and I thought, God, I am still doing this. And, and even then I wasn't even tired because... you know, what are the options for an aging drag queen, you know? So that's why I opened the bar. I kind of thought, oh, we'll try and make this a little pension thing. But it just has never stopped, and it's the only thing I know how to do. It's the only way I've made a living all of my life. I do still enjoy it. And you do then, as you get older, you have to push it into different ways.
Yeah.
Like when I was 25, I could make a living by being just totally outrageous in nightclubs, you know, wearing insane, stupid outfits, getting drunk. You know, that was literally what my job was. Whereas I can't do that when I'm 46, and I wouldn't want to be doing it when I'm 46. So over time, you find other ways. So that's why I went into doing the theater stuff much more seriously, or writing, or whatever, you know. And I'm sure your act isn't the same now as it was when you were 20.
Thank God. I think it's a remarkably brave thing. And maybe when you're the person who is doing it, the bravery isn't as apparent to you as it is to me and to the rest of us, that the kind of the self-confidence especially in a country like Ireland, maybe Dublin's a bit different, and maybe being a drag queen in Tubbercurry or or Moat is a bit more difficult.
Ballinrobe, County Mayo. Yeah.
Are you from, you're a Mayo boy?
Yes, I'm from Ballinrobe.
Ah, fair play. Oh my God, that's pure transvestite country. Like.
Well, you know, a couple of weeks
being
ago...
Being a transvestite would be the least of your troubles in Ballinrobe. Like.
A few weeks ago, I went down there and I did a full show in a marquee that they set up in the car park in the middle of Ballinrobe. Like, it was nuts.
Wow. But anyway, it seems to me a proud heart thing to be doing. And where the country is richer and more beautiful after people like you being in it. So it's funny. I didn't know, I obviously didn't know you were coming on, but the story I told just before you came on about caterpillars climbing into sleeping bags.
I'm the butterfly in this analogy,
and
right?
Butterfly walking out. So thank you so much for coming to the show, ladies and gentlemen.
No.
Thank you so much. We'll see you after the break. Wow. That was amazing. Wow, thank you so much. That was brilliant. All the way from Cabra, we could call it Cabrap. All right, Fred, who we got next?
Our second guest, Tommy Tiernan, is Mr. Donal Ryan!
The writer. Donal, how are you? How are you, fella? A spinning heart. Is that you?
The spinning heart. Close enough.
The spinning heart. How, you're a writer, Donal.
I am.
I've just reminded you who you are. And everyone's mad for your books. Oh, there was a time there, Jesus, you couldn't turn left or right. Oh, mad for Donal Ryan.
Well, not everyone, though, in fairness. But yeah, a lot of people.
Ah, fair amount of them now. And do you live out the country someplace, don't you?
Well, I live in Limerick, in the city. But this is close enough to the country. It's Castletroy. It's a suburb, we'll say. There are fields near my house. And I can see a mountain.
Like, do you have a photograph of a mountain in the kitchen or something? No. How is the writing going for you? Like, you had phenomenal success with The Spinning Heart.
Yes.
Is that the one that was about the recession and each of the, like, 12 different...
Yeah, there was 21 characters and they were all in the same village, which was pretty much, you know, the village I grew up in geographically.
What village did you grow up in?
A village called Newtown in Tipperary, near Nina.
Oh, Tipperary's an awful, awful county.
I've heard this before, actually.
Yeah. Now, my mother was from Clonmel. There's no ocean in Tipperary. They're surrounded by mountains. Like, I always thought, if you really want to scare a Tipperary girl, to take her to the beach. That water's got a mind of its own. So you grew up in Tip.
I did.
And then moved to Limerick.
Yes.
Jesus. Now, you see, if you'd have grown up anywhere else, you could have gone to New York or Paris. But that's how limiting Tipperary is.
You're right. It's 20 miles in the road. And actually,
Do you drive through Oola?
I don't. That's the other direction. Well, I did. I thought, until I went to Limerick, I thought that I had a totally flat accent that I spoke in kind of received pronunciation. There was no such thing. A Tipperary accent didn't exist. Till I got to Limerick, and I had no idea what they were saying, and they had no idea what I was saying.
So it was great. I better write it down.
Yeah, that's why I started writing. Exactly. Yeah.
this spoken word thing isn't going to work out. They're going to need cue cards. So, was The Spinning Heart the first book you wrote?
No, I wrote a book before it called The Thing About December, then I wrote Spinning Heart straight after it, but they published Spinning Heart first because, and not that it was better, but I think they thought it would appeal to people more quickly. But that was fine by me. I mean, it did well. Spinning Heart did great. But, you know, it wasn't universally liked. I mean, I have a huge talent for focusing almost completely on the negative.
Oh, yeah, join the club. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I could go to a reading and there could be a queue of 40 people getting a book signed. I'll see one person in the queue about halfway down with their lips pursed like that. And I know what's going to happen. Yeah. And I know they'll preface their excoriation with, "You're not going to like what I have to say to you now, Donald. So I've developed kind of a strategy for dealing with it. I just say, I'll go to the toilet so, and hopefully before I come back, you'll be finished saying it. Yeah, and then I do, I go away, I walk away. And I come back, and normally you're still there waiting, but... So I'll go on, just say it. And then, you know, out of the 40 people, that one person's comments would stay with me for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It's hard, around my head, yeah.
It's hard country that, you know, it's kind of
the
self-loathing disguised as strangers.
Yeah.
It's a tough situation.
Exactly. Like.
What kind of style of writing do you have? Is it a very... I haven't read the books now, but it's a very open style, I'm guessing. Easy to read without being... cheap, is that the...
It is a thing. I kind of tend to write mostly in the vernacular. So far, anyway. I mean, my third novel isn't as much now, and my short stories aren't as much. But the first two novels are written almost exclusively in the demotic, like in ordinary speech of rural Ireland. So, you know, words are kind of written phonetically almost in places. And, you know, that's because this was easy for me, basically. This is the way I could get the book written. And the voices all ring true, because I wanted the gap between... the reader and what's written down to be as narrow as possible. But you know, I mean, when you do that, you run the risk of being accused of petty wackery. And that happens, and I'm okay with it, you know.
Yeah.
But the first time I was ever accused of petty wackery was by a very, very posh lady. And I thought she was coming over to tell me I was great, because she was smiling at me. But it was kind of menacing, the smile that I hadn't clocked straight away, you know. So she started telling me that the only reason I was on the Booker Prize long list was because the English were all laughing at us again. And the English were delighted because I was bringing back petty wackery and I was ruining the whole thing for everybody. So I kind of thought...
That's a fierce form of snobbery, that.
Oh, yeah, it is. I thought so. You see, she thought I made it all up, that these things never happened, that no one spoke this way, because I suppose she'd never been in tip. Well, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
But people do say, I hear people say it all the time, and Marie tells me I made this up now, but I heard once, I was starting to read at an event, and I heard this girl, and she was very nice now, said to her friend, oh my God, is that like really his accent? Or is he just putting it on for like the reading?
Yeah. Well, is that one of the unbelievable?
Yeah. Oh yeah, that happens too. People go to me, you're exactly like Pat Short. You're exactly like him in every way. I don't think we're like, not in every way, but maybe we have, you know, things in common.
Is there there's an adventure with words which, if you give yourself permission to go on it, and even though you might from snobs invite judgment, like oh you're just, why are you playing up that whole Irish thing, just giving the English an excuse to laugh at us? But there's a great adventure to be had. I came across this amazing word yesterday from County Louth, and it's brash. The word is brash, right? And it means a half vomit that you do after eating bacon and cabbage.
Okay, that's brilliant.
I'm just heading out for a brash. So I was trying to think of other words. Like I come up with this one, a colic, which is the burp you do after drinking Coke too quick. So there's a great adventure.
Oh, it sure is.
So when you're writing, like, I presume part of it is to make yourself laugh and get excited about words, even though you're aware a little bit that you're putting on an act, but to give yourself permission to have fun with words like that.
Oh, I suppose. I mean, at times you have to put on an act, because I mean, I'm not my characters, even though I suppose there are traits of me in every character I write. But it's an act of empathy. You have to pretend to be somebody else for the time you're writing. But
wasn't there phenomenal anger in the spinning heart of not wanting the people who seem to have been the architects of our misfortune, even though we all had a hand in it, like we all got Egypts, but there seem to be some people who seem to be more responsible than others and to suffer less. And when the feeling I got when I was reading about your book was that part of it was your anger going, I can't allow this to go unchecked and unremarked upon. Would that be right? Did that fuel part of it?
It was definitely part of it. It wasn't kind of the spark that lit Spinning Heart, because I'd had the idea for years of writing a novel in that form, in a kind of polyphonic form. But it's funny, actually, I met a man in France, in Paris, and I did a reading, and I was on with Colm O'Regan, actually. And it was a great gig, and afterwards, this man came over to me and he said, Donal, Spinning Heart, where do I start? I mean, none of that ever happens, Donal. You do know that, don't you? And he was totally serious. And I looked him in the eye and he was unwavering. He was completely serious. I mean, this guy now was a tax exile. Well, he was an exile of some kind. And I qualified with tax, I presume. I suppose I shouldn't presume.
Yeah. He might have been on a witness protection program.
Yeah,
he
should have been. He had lovely shirt, though, and he had lovely shoes. So I
reckon whoever Panty is probably on the witness protection program. Killed a few people up north and said, I'll go down south and look as a woman.
Yeah.
So go on. So he couldn't believe that.
Oh, he said, I'm a developer and my son is a developer and we've been builders our lives and none of that happened, you know. I said, I'm sure, you didn't defraud your employees, you know, and I'm sure you didn't leave people in the lurch. But, I mean, it did happen. I mean, this is a matter of public record. You know, I mean, I know myself from life, from where I'm from, people I know, people I'm related to, you know, things that happened. I mean, we all know it happened. I mean, but it was funny. It was not long after it all happened, this denial was starting. And he was completely adamant that it hadn't happened. That nobody in real life had treated people the way Porky Burke, who's the builder in my book, treated people.
Do you think that fellas took it harder on themselves after their session than women did? Because of all the, you know, our lives are filled with people who decided for one reason or another that they couldn't cope after what had happened. But it seemed to be mainly fellas. A lot of men seemed to say, "Jeez, lads, I'm done with the pressure of this. Like, I'm out of here." Why do you think that fellas? Why do you think it was men that bore the brunt of all that pressure?
I think this is just a thing that you could spend your whole life trying to explain and trying to study and trying to figure out why these things happen this way and why men react sometimes much more dramatically. I know a village in West Limerick where nearly every single fella in the village left school fairly early and went into a trade. Mm. You know, and you know, when the thing hit, this village was pretty much just this village of guys who could not get a day's work anywhere, you know. And you could see the sadness and desperation and then guys just heading off and kind of blaming themselves and feeling foolish, you know. Mm. Even though up to that point they were getting 700-800 euros a week into their hand, no questions asked. Maybe 1,000 euros a week, working all the hours got sent, thinking there's no end to this, because why would they think there'd be an end to this, you know? Yeah. And like, then this happened, and their whole way they saw the world and themselves changed. And crucially, like, the way they saw themselves really changed.
Yeah.
And this kind of feeling of foolishness almost crept into the way we thought about ourselves. Just awful, a horrible tragedy.
It's, do you feel now, because I remember when I started doing stand-up, Ireland, this is one of the great things Charlie Haughey did now. Artists could live tax-free, which is a mighty idea. A great way of encouraging people into the arts, you know, because you don't have to pay tax. So what happened was that all these bands, like I think the Thompson Twins and Lisa Stanfield and all these English superstars, you know, moved over to Ireland and didn't have to pay any tax on their earnings. It was to encourage young people to get into the arts, you know, and stuff like that. But it also meant that superstar authors, you know, like Maeve, God rest her, mighty woman, but that she, you know, couldn't be earning 50 or 60 million quid a year completely tax-free, you know, having a laugh. And... So even though for all your concern about Irish people and defrauding the tax man, do you sometimes wish you were born about 20 years earlier?
Oh, I mean, the year my book came out was the year I went down to 40,000 euros. And then I sold 200,000 copies at a big load of tax. So it was horrifying, all right. And I mean, the worst thing is, like, for 15 years I was a civil servant, so I was kind of blamed for causing the whole thing anyway, you know, because I was sponging off the rest of the taxpayers for 15 years. And then my neighbour across the door keeps going, "You're paying no tax." Well, I do. Everything over 40, over 40 grand, you know. So, I have to pay tax.
Fair play. That's the great thing about being Irish. One minute you're giving out about people who've avoided tax, and the next minute you're complaining, "Well, I have to pay it as well." Just, no wonder we rolled ourselves into the ground in fairness. Who are you riding? Yourself. So the is there a new book out?
Yeah, I have a book coming out in September called A Slanting of the Sun. I nearly forgot, actually. A Slanting of the Sun is short stories. And I have a novel coming out next March or April that I just handed in last week to my editor. And it's about... Well, say what it's about.
Please,
it's about...
Because we're not going to read it, so you might as well tell us now.
Yeah.
I've seen the whole thing, no.
The novel is about... I'm just hoping on the premise alone, it'll sell a load of books for me, but the novel is about a teacher who has an affair with a young traveller who she's teaching to read and write. She's 33 and he's 17 and she becomes pregnant.
Whoa, slow down. Slow down there, you have me.
Don't make me say it again, though.
Jess, if it's ever been made into a film, give us a shout. So hang on, so slow down. So give me the ages again. The teacher is how old?
Well, at the moment, it's not edited yet, so it could change, but she's 33.
Oh, the teacher, it's a lady teacher and a young traveller gossip of 17.
That's right.
Wow. And what happens?
You'll have to buy it. You'll have to read it and see. I'll send you a copy.
But did they go anywhere? Like, where is it set?
It's set in the same village that my first two novels are set in, and pretty much all my short stories. in some respects, I have no imagination at all.
You have to tell us something now, because
I said too much already. I'm actually in trouble at the moment.
He said nothing. a 32-year-old teacher and a 17-year-old travelling lad have an affair. Do they fall in love with each other, or does one fall in love more than the other? Or?
It's kind of mutual, and then it kind of goes scareways after that, and loads of things happen. They don't go very far, actually.
Does she have a baby, like a half traveller, half settled baby?
Yeah, the child's born 1 year pierced.
What? Well, it sounds, honest to God, that's a fantastic premise for a story. I wish you what's it called again? The Slanting Sun.
The short stories are called The Slanting of the Sun, and the novel is called A Drifting Smoke.
A Drifting Smoke. We wish you the best luck with Donal Ryan. Thanks very
Tommy.
Much for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
We'll see you after this short break. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. This is the final show. We're done after this. We had not the longest running chat show in the world. I know the Late Late Show has been going for 40 or 50 years, and we just did four episodes. So I want to thank you all so much for listening over the past couple of weeks. I want to thank my producer, Trace Kelly, who had the most difficult job of trying to choose people who I might be able to have a conversation with. So a big round of applause for my producer who did all the work, Trace Kelly. I hope you all have a fantastic August, and I hope that the sun shines brightly on all of us, and when it rains, I hope it's healing rain. I hope it's the rain that cleans your mind and makes us all feel better. To play us out, ladies and gentlemen, playing their song 26 Laws, which is from their album 1988, which is available on iTunes. Please give another round of applause for the brilliant Lethal Dialect. Good luck. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.